It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. It's Workers' Memorial Day, and it's one of the days that I like to spend a little time remembering the folks that I've known throughout the years who have been injured and killed on the job. Many of them senseless injuries. Many of the loss of life that I've known, totally senseless. And it's kind of one of those moments where you recommit. The old Mother Jones line, mourn the dead, but fight like hell for the living. And remembering those who, who've been sacrificed. Just because they got up and they went to work to support their families, to keep a roof over their heads, to do whatever it is that they were doing to make their way in this world, and they didn't go home. And I've known a couple of people over the years who sadly that has happened. And I always think of a truck driver that I knew, years ago. A guy who, salt of the earth, adopted 8 kids. He and his wife, had this huge, huge family, and just one of these guys who was just a fabulous guy. And, worked as hard as anybody you'll ever know. Never missed a day of work. And freak accident, something happened. Nobody gave us an official reason why. Many of us who have driven for years have our thoughts. My problem is I thought it was the braking system in the truck that he was using because of the way that they configured it. But every time, and it's been probably, it's got to be 20 years now that he was killed. I go by that spot on Route 70, on I-78, and I look at that spot and I remember him and I think about his family. And if you've lost somebody on the job, you know what I'm talking about. There's that kind of shock that, that could have happened to any one of us. And we've got to do more. We've got to do better to ensure that bad things don't happen. And I remember that he was sent out with a set of with a load and an empty trailer and a set of doubles and the old Freightliner tractors that we used to have. You'd hit the brakes, nothing had happened. You hit the brakes, nothing happened. All of a sudden, they'd lock up. And the thought was, and they had these giant, big old white steering wheels with no power steering. And the thought, from those of us who, combed over it again and again and again, were that, he did that. He was getting off at the exit to go to the rest stop and hit the brakes, nothing. And all of a sudden, on a wet night, they locked up. And he jackknifed, slid, hit the wall, and then directly down into the embankment, nose first, and crushed. Didn't stand a chance. And I still remember his wife coming to the facility. I still remember her talking about what she's going to do now. They had 8 kids. And at the time, we had taken up collections and we had done all those things that you do. But that only lasts so long. And I hope they got a good settlement and they're taken care of. And that they were okay going forward. But still, that loved one isn't there. I've had other people that I've known. A guy was working, digging a ditch and was doing waterproofing and was literally crushed when the wall that they didn't have secured properly, basically collapsed on him. It's these things. And you talk to people in the building trades, you talk to people in the construction industry where this stuff as possible. You talk to people in manufacturing. My former father-in-law worked in steel, and he would tell the stories of, you know, people who accidentally fell into the giant vats of steel, and they were just evaporated. That you didn't find anything left of them. And, you know, how, you know, back in the old days, it was frequent, and employers didn't care. Because there's 100 guys waiting to take that job. If you were dumb enough to slip and fall or trip or get knocked over and into the vat you went, well, too bad. And what we did as a country, as a working class, we said no more. We said we want safer working conditions. And you go back 100 years. You go back into the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You go back to those early factory jobs that were horrible. Poverty wage conditions, deplorable working conditions. Back during the Lochner era of, if you're desperate enough and you're hungry enough to work for those peanuts in horrible conditions, that's your right, that's your liberty, it's your freedom. When all it was desperate people trying to feed their kids and putting themselves at risk. And what we did as a country, what we did as a working class, is we organized. And we said no more. We're going to fight for every working person and make sure that working conditions are safe, that people go home at the end of their shift. And one of the things that I think we've learned during this pandemic, and this is one of those things that I've been talking about for the entire pandemic, we needed a real active OSHA. We needed a federal government that was going to protect workers in the workplace. And what we got out of the Trump administration was none of that. In fact, they defunded the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to the point to where the number of inspectors that they had during the Trump years were the lowest that they'd ever been in the history of OSHA. And people died because of it. Now, granted, you know, we gave them nice names. We gave them, threw them praise, and maybe some peanuts. Hero, essential. Gave a little hero pay, just a couple of pennies, got press releases, and then those companies clawed it all back. In fact, I look at Kroger out in Washington State, where they closed up shop because I think Seattle was the place where they had said, well, you know, if you're going to call these people heroes, you're going to have to give them hero pay. And Kroger said, nope, we're not doing it. And they hightailed out of time. Closing stores down. So much for the hero designation. And for me, this is one of those days where I think it's important to remember and think about your own conditions. Because we're in this moment of a pandemic. An airborne pathogen. Did we do enough to protect workers? I don't believe so. Could we do more? Absolutely. And this is why I think during these moments, it's where we remember those who have passed. And like I said, Mother Jones, mourn the dead, fight like hell for the living. And I'm hoping that tonight in Joe Biden's State of the Union, he mentions Workers Memorial Day. He mentions the people who have died in the name of just trying to support their families. And I hope that, you know, coming out of this not-so-state-of-the-State-of-the-Union address, we get policies that are going to make lives easier for workers and their families. Easier to organize in the workplace, easier to fight for safer working conditions, easier to do the things that we know are going to be helpful. Now, I guess one of the big things that's going to come out is the American Families Plan, which I think is a good proposal. I don't see that it's going to have much of a chance of being passed, thanks to having a Republican almost majority. You got 50-50 split right there. And, of course, you know, a couple of Democrats who I don't know that would come along. But this is a good idea. Increasing funding for child care so that families can get good, affordable child care. I don't think that's a bad thing. Making sure that workers have paid leave. Not a bad thing. Things we should have been fighting for all along. Good things on the education front. universal pre-K, which we've been talking about forever. And then something that I've been saying for a long time, you know, he's pushing something like $109 billion for free community college. I've said we should go further than this, and we should mandate that community colleges become part of the regular education system, that everyone has to go for two more years of mandatory education. And I go, oh, you can't do that. They're adults at 18. They can do what they want. You're right. They can. And if they want to be stupid and they want to do something else, they can do that. But I think you have to then, you know, it used to be eighth grade was the cutoff. You got to eighth grade. Now you've graduated. Now you can go work in the factory. And then we said, no, we need to get to 12 years. I'm saying now you need to extend that to 14. You need to get that associate's degree out of the community college. You need to get that trade certificate that you can you take what you learned in the vo-tech classes, and now you're a certified whatever, that you have actual saleable skills. And it not put families in a lifetime of debt. I mean, this is the remarkable part, and this is why I think this plan and doing what Joe Biden is doing is important, because look, this stuff is popular. This stuff is what the American families have been talking about for a long time. Republicans have been giving lip service. Biden's actually got a plan to go forward with it. And how's he going to pay for it? Simple. We're going to tax the rich people. We're going to undo 40 plus years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics. We're going to undo the conservative, horrible ideas that got us into this mess in the first place of creating the largest billionaire class in history. We're going to undo some of that. We're going to redistribute wealth back the way it was before they redistributed it. And we're going to do that with a sane and rational tax code. And we're going to spend money, going after the tax cheats. They believe there's a boatload of money out there. They believe that they can raise, and this is mind-blowing when you stop and think about it. They believe that they can raise $700 billion just from actually having the IRS do its job. Because they think they can raise the taxes to pay for all of these plans. By raising the top marginal tax rate, raising taxes on corporate America, raising the capital gains tax, all things that I've talked about for years. And this isn't even going back to where I've been talking about, going back to the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower with the 92% top marginal tax rate. They're simply talking about 39.6. And then they're going after the tax cheats. And it's something that we've needed for a very long time, because what we've done is we've continually given away. And you know, look at the tax cuts that the last guy did. $1.9 trillion in money that we just kind of gave away. And, you know, it kind of fizzled. We had a little tiny bump. But for the most part, it was just, you know, paying back CEOs and buyback plans and shareholder taking more. Now it's time to say we need to have a broader approach. We need work to matter. We need to reward work and return that reward and that dignity that comes with earning a reasonable wage. That's why, again, I'm thrilled to see some of the plans that are coming out of this. Some of the ideas that we've been talking about on this show for 16 years. The idea that we need to get people good skills. We need to get them good jobs, good union jobs with decent wages, with health care security, with retirement security, with safety. And you do that through policy. I know a lot of my right-wing friends are, no, Rick, it's the invisible hand. It's the markets do that. What the markets do effectively is they effectively pick winners and losers. A handful of winners and everyone else loses. They effectively enrich the people with the power. They effectively enrich the people with the access. We've seen this play out. I look at the fact that Amazon, one of the wealthiest companies in the world, spent $200 million crushing an organizing campaign because they don't want to share. This is one of those opportunities, and I'm interested to see the reception. I'm interested to see how people start looking at government maybe a little bit differently as a partner in setting a net under our feet to give us the ability to go and do great things like my grandparents' generation did. This isn't new. We're not Magellan discovering new territory. This isn't space exploration. This is stuff that we've done in the past, creating a safety net under people's feet, making sure that we say, you know, as a society, nobody falls through. And we start with opportunity for kids. We move that right through, you know, opportunity for a higher education, for when adults become the workers of the next generation, that they have the skills. This is smart stuff. And yet all I hear from the right is, well, it's about, I don't want to wear a mask. I don't want you banning a book that no one's banning. I want to continue to call Potato Head Mr. Potato Head. And you're free to do that. You can still find the books that the publisher decided they're not going to continue to print. They're still out there. All that stuff is still available. But, you know, it's the shiny thing. It's the thing that we've been told that we've got to follow. All the while, you got a guy in the White House right now who's just showing up doing the job. Just showing up doing the job. Happy as can be about that. And we'll see where these policies go, because ultimately it's going to come down to Republican voters. Do you want these things? Republican voters, do you want your kids to be able to go to college? Do you want them to get universal pre-K? Do you want them to have the kind of future that we all talk about wanting our kids to have? If so, get your party on board. And look, if you don't like the ideas, propose something else that's going to get us to these places. I'd love to hear them. I'd love to hear the ideas. And you can send them to me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jimmy Williams from IUPAT is going to be here to share some thoughts on Workers' Memorial Day. Right back. Stick around. There's nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day the Occupational Safety and Health Act went into effect. At the time, it was estimated that 14,000 workers died annually on the job, 2.2 million workers were permanently or temporarily disabled, and 500,000 developed occupational diseases each year. It was estimated that at least 25 million serious injuries and deaths went unreported each year. Many of the standards, regulations, and enforcements OSHA now has have come as a result of intense, continuous pressure waged by the labor movement. The Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union was the first to test out the new bill when they filed a complaint against the Allied Chemical Company in Moundsville, West Virginia, in May of 1971. Among the many hazards at the facility, pools of mercury on the shop floor were common occurrences. OSHA issued its first citation against Allied Chemical under the General Duty Clause. The first OSHA standard issued came a year later for asbestos. Today, the AFL-CIO notes that for the year 2015, 4,836 workers were killed on the job. There is only one OSHA inspector for every 76,000 workers, and on average, it would take OSHA 145 years to inspect every workplace in the country. But new rules protecting workers from silica dust and beryllium have been established, as have strong reporting and record-keeping standards. There are stricter coal dust standards and anti-retaliation protections for workplace whistleblowers. The Trump administration is currently looking to overturn all of it. You can take action this Workers' Memorial Day to protect working conditions on the job by finding an event in your area by going to aflcio.org. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. We'll be right back. back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So this day, as I said, Workers' Memorial Day, where we remember those who have fallen, our coworkers who have fallen over the years, remember who they were, their families, and then we pledge to make sure that the conditions in the future are such that we don't lose any more. Or as the old Mother Jones frame goes, mourn the dead, but fight like hell for the living. And here to share some thoughts on how we fight like hell for the living, I've asked Jimmy Williams to come talk with us. Jimmy's the General Vice President at Large for the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Jimmy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
So, you know, this day, we a special day for working people, where we remember those who, you know, got killed on the job. And, you know, I think back to the folks that I know, and I talked about one guy earlier, and just horribly tragic and sad and really harmful to the families, you know, especially the kids who, you know, they lost their father, as I remember. And it's just tragic.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think Workers' Memorial Day, at least in the last 2 years, has taken on such a different meaning in this time with COVID and the crisis that we're faced with the pandemic. And, you know, it's always good to take a pause and remember. I think, you know, we became a little numb over the last, you know, year and a half or so to the sheer volume of people that have been affected by the pandemic and the very nature of, like, their workplaces have been, you know, places where the virus has been spreading. I know in our union, very early in the pandemic, we had two members pass that worked at the same place at the New York City Housing Authority, and were going to work early in the pandemic, and they both contracted COVID, clearly on the job site, very hard to prove that, but and perished. And there's countless numbers of stories of all the frontline workers in healthcare, construction, you know, grocery store workers, people that have worked through the pandemic and have suffered loss.
The folks that we called essential, the people that we called frontline heroes, those are the people you're talking about, right?
Absolutely.
And this becomes one of those moments where you have to take a step back. And because one of the things I hear a lot from people go, well, you know, we don't need unions anymore, Jimmy, because, yeah, that's something that happened a long time ago, because unfortunately, years ago, we were losing 100,000 workers a year. The numbers were staggering. And because unions did their job, because we pushed for sane, rational regulation and government action, and the two of them together brought those numbers down, it's not something that happens as often as it used to. But I argue it happens more than it should.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about, like, Workers' Memorial Day, you know, it was 1970 that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration was formed. 1970. Yeah. I mean, think of the countless millions of workers in the United States working in the mines, working in construction, working in high-risk jobs before the passage of the act that were just, you know, treated like they were meaningless. And, you know, I think far too often people forget the struggle and then also take advantage or take for granted the gains. And, you know, Workers' Memorial Day is a great day to look back on our history and recalibrate our fights for the future, because we're going to have to do something with infectious disease. You know, we were caught flat-footed with COVID. Our workplaces weren't safe. Right. And we do need to push hard to make sure that OSHA has a standard for infectious diseases going forward, because this is going to be here for and with us forever.
You're absolutely right. And what we need to do also is we need to rebuild OSHA. We need to refund it. We need to bring in more inspectors. During the last term, during the last president's term, OSHA inspectors had fallen to the lowest number in its history. The number I saw, it would take, I think, like 160 years for the current level of OSHA inspectors to inspect every workplace in the country. And you go 160 years to get to every one of them. And as you've said, with infectious diseases, you now can't narrow them out of which might be dangerous and which might not be. With infectious diseases, they all are. So this is something we really need to address.
No, that's for sure. You know, thankfully, we have an administration that's going to invest and rebuild and, you know, do the things necessary to support the government agencies that need the most help, you know, and that's a good thing. But we do have to push for legislation as well. And we have to make sure that any new and incoming administrations don't have the ability to gut the government agencies that are there to protect the American workforce.
Right. Now, during the heart of the pandemic, we'd had a number of union leaders come on and talk about the work that they were doing to help keep their members safe. And overwhelmingly, you look at, especially in the food production industry, I had, you know, a Teamster local come on and talk about how right at the beginning of the pandemic, they had a couple of people get it. They immediately were in a very proactive way, did all of the things to do to keep their members safe and didn't lose anybody. We're just 15 miles down the road. You had the Tyson plant that lost a whole bunch of people and half the place was infected. It was a nightmare. And for me, this goes back to another reason why we need strong unions, why workers need to have that voice on the job, and why, looking at what happened at Amazon, why we need comprehensive labor law reform. And, you know, the PRO Act to me is not perfect. I still say we need to repeal Taft-Hartley entirely and go back to the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act. But the PRO Act is a step in the right direction. Do you see any way of us getting there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's front and center, right? And we still have work to do. We have three United States senators in the Democratic caucus that still needs to be moved. But the president of the United States has made it a priority. And thank God. For the first time in our generation, or at least in my lifetime, a sitting president has made strengthening unions a priority, even created and announced a task force this week within the White House of his key advisors, including Marty Walsh and including the Vice President of the United States. And it's not just something that was put together to appease unions like has been done in the past. I mean, it's legitimate. It's going to be a fight. It's going to be a struggle for sure. You know, the president also put forth the American Families Plan this week. And, you know, these are all positive things for the American family and the American workforce. But it's always going to be a fight and it's going to be a struggle. Nothing's ever easy. Nothing's ever won easy. And we still got work to do to push portions of the PRO Act across the finish line. Will we be able to get through without any Republican support? Probably not. A clean version of the PRO Act. However, you know, if we fight and we push and we demand, we could maybe remove the filibuster and we could definitely get pieces through reconciliation that can help the American workers and the American labor movement.
No, it's something we definitely need. And the reason I bring this up on Workers' Memorial Day is look, you know, we don't know what the future holds. We've learned lessons from this pandemic. We've learned the lessons of what an ineffective government has done. We've learned the penalties that working people, we've given them nice names, essential worker, frontline hero, even threw them a couple of pennies with the praise, and then immediately clawed it back. I want to make sure that in the future, we're much more proactive in protecting our coworkers and ourselves. You know, the life you might save might be your own. So for me, this day, this moment is about remembering those who have passed, mourning their passing, promising to help their families, but also promising to make sure we don't allow this to happen again in the future.
Yeah, and I think of the countless, you know, thousands of non-union workers that don't have the protections of a labor union on a day like today. Because, you know, we mourn for our membership, but, you know, the most vulnerable are those workers that are working in high-risk jobs without the benefit of a labor union. And you know, that's where we need support. That's where we need things like the PRO Act, but we also need an active federal government to clean up those most vulnerable workers that are out there. You know, our unions do provide the highest level of health and safety training. We do have all of the programs needed to support our membership through hard times like this pandemic and others. But I just think about the countless, you know, millions of American workers that don't have the benefit of a union.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, unions get painted a lot of times as narrow self-interest. Oh, you care about your members. And it's true. Unions do care about their members. They want their members to get better wages, hours, conditions. There's no shying away from that. But overall, you know, unions do fight for the betterment of all workers in this country. And you know, I'll fight anybody anywhere to prove that to be true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I'll bring up an example within our industry. You know, way back when, lead-based paint was the, you know, the way that paint was manufactured and made in this country, and it was a poisonous thing for painters, whether they were in a union or not in a union. And you know, 25% of all the deaths related to lead poisoning was from the painting industry, and we had to fight back then. To have lead-based paint removed. And, you know, we're still dealing with that crisis today with people that live in homes that were constructed years and years ago that still have lead-based paint in their systems. And, you know, it's a health risk, but unions fought for everybody when they fought for that, just like the mine workers and the mine health and safety, you know, reforms that were won. That's what unions do. They don't do that just for their membership.
For me, it's when the conditions rise, they rise for everyone. And unions have been the driver in that. Now, you brought up a moment ago that the Biden administration has put together this task force headed up by Marty Walsh, the Labor Secretary, and Kamala Harris, the Vice President, the Task Force on Worker Organizing and Empowerment. How do you see that being used and playing out for average, everyday working people? Because for me, this is the first time in my lifetime that my government has said that we are not only going to give you the lip service that you have the right, but we're actually going to promote your right and encourage your right. To me, that's a monumental moment.
Yeah, and I think it's twofold, right? Look, if we can't get the PRO Act passed, we have to organize 2022 in the midterm cycle to build a bigger majority. And we have to be bringing our organizing stories to that task force. We have to be bringing the issues to light, and having a voice that can be heard is an exciting thing for the labor movement, but it's incumbent upon us to bring our stories, to bring, you know, the cases of workers that are misclassified in the construction industry forward so that Secretary Walsh and the Vice President of the United States can hear and see and put a face on the real issues that the American workers faced with. I also think there's a big side of this too, that, you know, the Supreme Court ruled, you know, terribly against us for public employees back with the Janus decision. And I know the federal government is going to try to do everything they can to strengthen federal employees' rights too, and promote collective bargaining in the public sector, which is really, really important as well.
It's something we most certainly desperately need. Now, the last line of questioning I want to get to you with, because there's I know you guys have been on the front of immigrant rights and pushing for dignity and respect for all folks. And one of the things, being in the workplace, the reason that I'm in favor of immigrant rights is because I don't believe we can afford to have people in the shadows. I don't think we can afford to have exploitable, disposable people working among us. So I want them out of the shadows. I want them to have protections, and I want them to be able to blow the whistle on bad employers. You guys are in the middle of that mix, and you're calling on the Biden administration to protect those immigrant wage theft whistleblowers.
Yeah, we have been really at the forefront of the immigration battle, and things got stalled under Trump because there was just not going to be any sort of action. But, some of this stuff is important, and being able to create things like deferred action for workers that speak out against their employers so that they can be whistleblowers is important. And having the Department of Labor working closely with the Department of Homeland Security so that it's not one of these where they point to the other and say, well, there's nothing I can do. Well, no, there is. And having that interagency work is really important so that workers can come forward. On Worker Memorial Day, I think it's important to recognize the contribution that the immigrant workforce has brought to our country. And quite frankly and sadly, it's the most easily exploitable workforce and the ones that are working in the most danger, at least in our industry.
Right.
And so we've been extremely, vocal and supportive of saying early in this administration, let's give those workers their voice. Let's have them step forward outside the shadows, get deferred action, not be afraid to speak up, because it's the employers who are abusing them.
No, you're absolutely right. And look, we want the highest standards possible, the best wages, the best working conditions. And when you have people who are exploitable, it tears that down, and we can't have that. I believe we need to pull people out of the shadows, give them rights on the job, and make conditions better for all of us. Because sadly, and I've worked with a number of immigrant rights folks who have told just horror stories about the kind of work that they do. In fact, there was one point where I was going to go down and pick tobacco in North Carolina. We couldn't arrange it for a whole bunch of reasons. But I was going to go down and spend a week with these folks. But the horror stories of the conditions and being covered with these covers and pesticides and just horrible stuff that you or I would never allow to have happen are happening to these people simply because they're exploitable.
Rick, if anybody's listening and wants to learn more on the subject, go to our Twitter account, go to GoIUPAT, and watch some of the videos that we put out this week around worker misclassification and what the immigrant workforce in the construction industry is up against. Some of it's gut-wrenching, and some of it will definitely motivate you to maybe change your line of thinking when it comes to how we treat immigrant workers.
No, you guys have done a fantastic job. I mean, you guys have been on the forefront of drawing attention to this. So the question that comes into it, because, you know, your membership has been painted as somewhere, you know, in the middle, you know, divided, you know, how do you get, you know, how do we get people on board with this? Because immigration is one of those hot button issues. There are folks who think we shouldn't allow people in, slam the door, throw the ladder down. How do you bridge that gap?
You certainly don't run from it. And you know, I've seen unions that have run from it, and I think it doesn't help their agenda. You have to take the issue to the membership. You have to explain to the membership that the enemy is not the worker, that the enemy is the employers. It is the system above the worker. And, you know, our membership is no different than any other membership within the construction industry. Yeah, they are torn on it because they want someone to blame. Donald Trump played off of that. And thankfully, you know, those days are over for him, but the feelings still exist inside of our membership. And we just don't run from it. It's continuous education. It's constant communication. And, you know, I do have hope that the younger workforce in this country doesn't have those same types of beliefs. And if we can continue to promote and become more diverse as a union, then we can get past some of those divide issues that happen. And we believe that.
Yeah, you guys do really good stuff. And I do hope folks will check out your Twitter account. We'll get links out so folks can take a look at that. Also, the website, iupat.org. We'll get links out so folks can take a look at that. Jimmy, keep up the great work. I love having you on the program. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Rick.
I'd love to hear your stories on this Workers' Memorial Day. Did you lose someone on the job? So shoot me an email, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'd like to hear your story. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the American Federation of Hosiery Workers merged with the Textile Workers Union of America. Hosiery workers had begun organizing as early as 1909. By 1923, the American Federation of Full Fashion Hosiery Workers, as the union was originally called, had affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. Women made up the majority of those employed in the industry. Competition within the industry was fierce and a major focus for the early union. From its founding, the union was known for its progressive stances. It focused not only on contracts, but also on social welfare programs such as pensions and health insurance. During the Great Depression in 1933, the union pushed for the founding of a low-rent housing project in Philadelphia. The result was the Carl Mackley Houses, a subsidized governmental housing project. The union operated a nursery school for residents of Carl Mackley and the surrounding community. When the Congress of Industrial Organizations broke off from the AFL, the hosiery union left with them as part of the Textile Workers Organizing Committee. In the spring of 1937, Pennsylvania hosiery workers held a sit-down strike. The strike was led by Emil Raive, a Polish-American worker who had joined the union when he was only 15 years old. The strike grew to include 50,000 workers and shut down the Pennsylvania hosiery industry. The workers won raises between 8 and 10%. In 1947, the hosiery workers decided that they did not want to pay the dues increase required by the CIO. They left the organization and reaffiliated with the AFL. Finally, in 1965, changes in the industry led the union to merge with the Textile Workers Union. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big news today, all over the CNNs and the MSNBCs and all over the place, the Fox News is even. Rudy Giuliani had his apartment and his office raided by the FBI looking for electronic devices. Understand, you know, Rudy's done some shady stuff and people are looking into it, and get used to it. We're going to see a lot more, because even, you know, even if you go beyond his work with the Ukraine, as my friend Bob Ney loves to remind me, Rudy Giuliani and his firm did work for the MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq, while they were on the terror list. But hey, it's Rudy, America's mayor. So maybe there's some who will give him a pass. Someone who I know who will not give him a pass, our good friend Jared Yates Sexton. He is the host of the fabulous podcast Muckrake. Also has written a terrific book, American Rule, How the Nation Conquered the World but Failed Its People. We'll get links on how you can check that out. Jared, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks. I'm feeling a little like I might not be able to make it through this segment. I'm so disappointed that Rudy Giuliani, America's mayor, who has always been such on the up and up, Rick. Like, it's incredible that this guy might have gotten entangled in something. I don't know if maybe he didn't know what he was doing. You know, he was just trying to fix an election and also have foreign actors interfere in an election. It seems like he had the best in heart. This seems like a big mistake, Rick.
No, I'm not buying that. but that's what we hear, isn't it? He's the guy who took down the mob. And yet, here he is tied up in a mob kind of scheme, isn't he?
Yeah, it's always weird how the people who take on the mob somehow or another end up acting like the mob a lot of the time, and they're kind of trying to push the mob off their corner of the block. I mean, Rudy Giuliani has been pulling these stunts for the longest time. And the thing is, eventually it just kept going and going and going. And like you said, he's been involved in some dirty business. I mean, some real dirty, dirty business. And to try and interfere in a presidential election by trying to work through organized crime in Ukraine and Russia just to try and overthrow an election. I mean, this thing was a long time coming. It really was. And you have to think, with somebody like Giuliani, if they're not completely in the cups or they're not just completely delusional, they have to expect that knock on the door at some point, because this was playing with fire for years.
Yeah, I had a bunch of people right away going, how can they possibly do that? He's the president's lawyer. There's lawyer-client privilege. And I say, yeah, that's true, unless he's complicit in the crime, unless he's the criminal doing it, then that's all out the window.
Yeah, it was something, wasn't it? I'm thinking back now. I don't know if enough time has passed that we've all forgotten Donald Trump's second impeachment. This was the guy who brought Donald Trump into the impeachment, who came up with this crazy scheme that brought Trump along. And you could tell that Trump had like no idea what was real, what was false, what was a lie, what was true. And Giuliani just kept going and going and going. I mean, this was pushing the envelope in a way that it was inevitable. And yeah. And to see it happen now it's shocking, but it's not surprising.
Now, the message that I'm getting from the right is, well, this is just, or as Rudy's legal lawyer said, this is legal thuggery, that this is, this, I had one guy tell me, this is what the left was claiming Donald Trump was going to do to Hillary. And I'm sure he tried. But this is what the left is doing, what they claim the right was doing. And they're going after a former president. Are they going after a former president?
I have no idea, but I'll tell you what, Donald Trump is going to test the maxim that former presidents don't get prosecuted. Because, I mean, I'm sorry, it was 4 years of reckless grift and greed. And everything, and that's the thing about Donald Trump. He was so artless in his corruption. It was so, I mean, like, he would go on TV and tell you he was being corrupt and that he was breaking the law. I mean, the fact that he has tried to see what a person can get away with the office of the president, like, it's incredible. And I have to tell you, the Justice Department does not want to go after a former president. The Justice Department does not want to go after Mr. Mayor or the lawyer or attorney for a former president. They forced this. They made this happen. I mean, at all costs, they made this happen.
Yeah, Rudy's going to have an interesting next year or two. And the fact that he's being named in lawsuits that are like, you know, like gazillions of dollars by the two voting companies. And I mean, this... his troubles are not going to end anytime soon.
Yeah, what is it his old associate Roger Stone used to say? It's his time in the barrel. I mean, he is deep, dark in the barrel right now. And I have to tell you, I've talked to enough people who have covered the Giuliani beat. He has left behind enough damning evidence over the past couple of years that, I mean, if people just start picking it up off the street like pennies, he is in a lot of trouble.
Well, I'm good for him. Good for him.
He earned it, Rick.
He did earn it. I'm right there with you. Speaking of earning it, your state of Georgia, evidently there's federal hate crimes have been charged against the three guys who I guess were driving around shooting this black guy, Ahmaud Arbery. But now they're charged with three federal crimes above and beyond the state crimes. Thoughts?
Well, first of all, the whole thing has been sickening from the very beginning. And, you know, this is something we've talked a few times about this. The American right, particularly because they're animated by white supremacy and the protection of capitalism through white supremacy, they've gone from dog whistles to bullhorns, right? And all of this violence, whether it's vigilantes in the street or whether it's law enforcement stepping on somebody's neck, this stuff has become more and more blatant and more aggressive. This was another situation, again, that is surprising but not shocking, right? Because this is something that we've been building towards, which is open violence. And we've seen it in America before. I mean, we've had, you know, epidemics of lynching. We've had vigilante violence. We've had paramilitary groups in the streets and in people's homes. It was unfortunate that things like this were inevitable, but they really were, particularly with the persuasion on the right.
Yeah, but you know, what you hear from the right is that, you know, that everything now is white supremacy, that everything is now this extreme. And I look at this and I'm going, I don't know what else to call this when three white guys chase down a black guy who's just jogging in a neighborhood and they execute him. I'm sorry, I don't know. I don't know what else to call that.
Yeah, one of the basic tenets of white supremacy is the idea that African Americans and people of color are constant sources of potential violence. I mean, this is one of the things, if people want to understand this, this is one of the reasons why the NRA has become one of the major influential organizations in the United States of America and why we can't do anything about mass shootings. It's because this is an organization that has partnered with the Republican Party to convince white people that they need these guns because at any moment they might need to fight a race war or protect their family from people. And it has gone from the idea of protection to offense. Going out and looking for problems and policing, much like the old slave patrols were, fugitive slave patrols were. I mean, this is an American tradition. That's the sad truth of it. What we're dealing with right now is nothing new, but in the light of day in 2021, it's ugly. It's documented. We have our cell phones. We're watching this stuff, but this is not new. This is America's legacy. And it's not a thing that is emerging, but it is a thing that is starting to get worse.
Yeah, on the gun issue, I had always said if you want to start seeing some of these gun nuts, you know, start talking about regulation, I say just start arming every black person and you'll see them change their tune. And look, I remember seeing the video of like 1,000 black guys carrying their AR-15s or whatever their costumes were walking up Stone Mountain, Georgia. That was a powerful moment.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember this, but this was right around 2008 to 2010. Fox News showed members of a black liberation group who were using their Second Amendment rights to open carry, and it led every show for months, if not years. And this is where they give up the game. Right? Because what it is it's about, no, certain people should be armed. And by the way, let's go ahead and take that to its logical conclusion. Only certain people should vote, which I think we've seen this too. Even the National Review is like, oh, maybe we don't need more people voting. We need better people voting.
Right.
And by the way, like, this is nothing, again, that's new. This is a resurgence of Jim Crow.
Right.
This is old American white supremacist tradition, which is all about maintaining political power, but also economic control. And the fact that all of this is starting to come up and it's all starting to grow more and more aggressive should tell you where we are in this country.
Now, when I brought that up, I had a black friend go, no, that's a bad idea, because then that's going to give them a reason to gun us down. And, you know, I didn't think about it in that way.
No, absolutely not. I mean, this is, you know, it's really easy sometimes. And this is the Republican trap. we've seen this for years, right? Which is, oh, they're doing this, so we should go ahead and have our own version of this. I noticed it a few months ago. Our listeners started talking about all of these Republican blogs and individuals who are like, maybe we need our own country, right? Maybe we should just go ahead and split and have two countries. And Rick, I haven't read a history book in a couple of days, but I saw what happened in the middle of the 19th century. And I have to tell you that when one country separates into another, they don't just separate. They go into separate corners and then they come out swinging.
Right.
So this is one of those things that we have to be very careful about, because they are engaging in bad faith politics, and that can lead us down a really insidious road.
Now, the scary part about this, to highlight what you're saying, is we just saw it was apportionment day the other day. Now we're seeing this southern shift in political power. Seven more congressional seats are being taken pretty much from the industrial Midwest that used to be the economic powerhouse, and moving its way into southern control. Politically, we could end up having a much different world in a couple of years.
Yeah, and you're talking my language here. I come from Indiana. I currently live down in Georgia. My family are factory workers, laborers, miners, those types of things. You know, what we have seen is largely an industrial shift. Down in the South, they basically have written blank checks to corporations and business owners that said, come down here, you're not going to have to worry about unions, you're not going to have to worry about regulations. Matter of fact, we're not even going to make you pay taxes, right? You're just going to come down here and live high off the hog. Well, guess what? People go where the jobs are. And the fact that those people have not been protected, they have not been advocated for, and basically in the two-party system, more or less, for years, has led to a demographic shift that is really disturbing. And I think this is one of the things that we're going to have to focus on in the next few years, which is a realignment of industry, a realignment of union solidarity movements. And we have to. We have corporations at this point that are not just monopolies, but they are like super monopolies, right? That are taking advantage of all of these things that the right has been pushing in their battle against organized labor and solidarity for years. So we're definitely seeing the numbers change. And a large part of it, I think, has to do with that.
No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, this is where I've been saying, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, basically abandoning working people from, oh, I don't know, my entire life. has been a bad thing. And so I'm glad to see Joe Biden is at least, you know, making some moves to try and strengthen labor laws. Because, look, if we can't organize the South, especially as this economic shift and political shift happens, we're quickly going to move into a kind of fascist country that most, I think, right-thinking people should be afraid of.
Yeah, and you know, let's just dip back into history and then jump forward a little bit. We don't spend a lot of time looking at the Civil War and why it happened. We like to do a little bit of paragraph and then talk about all of the battles. But one of the reasons that it occurred was because of shifts in terms of labor and economics. And what you ended up having in the South was not just a stratified hierarchical racial society, but a stratified labor society. Right? Where people were being held down, they weren't being paid anything, they weren't being taken care of. These things happen in cycles. But I think you and I talked, I want to say it was back in December after the election was finally decided. And we were talking about what Joe Biden could possibly be and what we expected out of this presidency. And you know, a lot of people have said to me, I didn't know Joe Biden was so progressive. I don't think he's progressive. I think that Joe Biden knows where the wind is blowing. And what we are seeing, and by the way, we're taping this before he gives his speech tonight. One of the things that, or maybe we're live, I don't know how things work. And so he's going to give this speech tonight. And you and I both watch Democratic presidents talk about, well, we would love to give money to things, but we can't. We just can't. We're in an age of austerity. The age of big government is gone. That's done. We don't live in that era anymore. Right. And even somebody who has been a moderate Democrat, and by the way, Joe Biden, folks, has been a friend of big businesses, corporations, banks, his entire life. He was the senator from Delaware,
yes,
of all states.
Yes.
He's not doing this because he's feeling like he wants to hand things out to people or he wants to bring back the era of big government. It's a necessity. This country will fall apart if we don't push back against exactly what you were talking about, that rightward shift in our economics and politics.
No, you're spot on. And I said it before, he was my fourth choice, maybe fifth. I'm not really sure. I'm still, he's right there in that, fighting for fourth, probably fifth. But he's rising to the moment. I think you're right. He's seeing what's going on and he's adjusting to it. And I'm glad so far that he has. Now, some people are saying he's not going far enough. I'm thrilled with how far he's going, and we need to push and make sure that he can. Because here's at the end of it, I do believe it comes back down: do you make people's lives better or do you make them worse? And I think if he gets an infrastructure bill pushed through, we get the $15 an hour minimum wage, at least on the federal level, as he's done, I think you're going to help make people's lives better. And then you make that argument of, do you really want to go back to what we had before?
Listen, I'm just thrilled we have a president who's not considering throwing a nuclear bomb in the middle of a hurricane.
Brian,
I'll be real. Yeah. But I will go ahead and I will say, and we've known this for a while, this has been an argument that people on the left have been telling Democrats for years. Stop being afraid of leftist progressive ideas.
Yep.
They're popular. And right now, Biden's popularity, it reflects the fact that helping people, making the government work for them, and ending the giant suck of redistributive wealth from the bottom to the top, and like actually returning something to the people and making this country a little bit fair, a little bit more human, there's a real possibility that fire will catch on. So the idea of moving further left and making that progress happen, it starts by those little victories that make the Democratic Party, who, by the way, they're like a scared little animal. They need to be coaxed out from underneath the bed, and they need to understand it's okay to go back to your roots and to go back to taking care of vulnerable populations and organized labor and solidarity. Once they realize that, there is always a possibility that they could go farther. And I'm with you. Right now, this is an encouraging beginning.
Yeah, it is. I like the way you put it. I like the way you put it better. It coaxed out, as where I'm saying, you need to boot them out into the middle. That's where we'll go. But Jared, always great talking with you. I always appreciate your thoughts and your insight. Thanks so much for your time.
You're the best, Rick. Thanks, man.
Good stuff, Jared Yates Sexton. Make sure you check out his podcast, the Muck Rake Podcast. Also, the book, American Rule, How a Nation Conquered the World But Failed Its People. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at that, and hopefully you pick it up. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day the Occupational Safety and Health Administration was founded. Since then, OSHA rules have become a powerful tool for the protection of workers' health and safety. Before OSHA, 38 people died on the job each and every day in the United States. April 28th is recognized around the world as International Workers' Memorial Day, or International Commemoration Day for the Dead and Injured. It is a day of mourning to remember all those who have been injured or lost their lives on the job. It is also a day to renew our commitment to the enforcement and strengthening of workplace safety standards. In 2012, Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis spoke at the Workers' Memorial Day commemoration in Los Angeles. In her speech, she recalled working conditions before OSHA, saying, "If you worked in a factory, you might lose your life or limbs in a heavy piece of machinery. There was no federal law requiring safety shields to prevent amputations. If you didn't like it, they told you to quit." But Secretary Solis also discussed the work still left to do for worker safety, saying, "Every day in America, 12 people go to work and never come home. Every year in America, nearly 4 million people suffer a workplace injury from which they may never recover. These are preventable tragedies," she said, "that disable our workers, devastate our families, and damage our economy. American workers are not looking for a handout or a free lunch. They are looking for a good day's pay for a hard day's work. They just want to go to work, provide for their families, and get home in one piece." For many, the motto for today comes from Mary Harris, who commanded workers to mourn the dead but fight like hell for the living.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.